This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 18th of April, 2015, on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Daniel Giacopelli, and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs broadcasted right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, we'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House, and The Monocle Daily. Coming up on the program,
there have been attempts, especially on the part of different Armenian groups, to raise awareness of the Armenian genocide because it's the centenary. But on the other side of the coin, different Turkish lobbyists have been trying to counter Armenian efforts.
We tried to get to the bottom of a century-old problem between Turkey and Armenia on Thursday's edition of The Globalist. Also coming up,
people he wanted to be, people he admired through his life, are people like Willy Brandt, who came from a fairly similar background, but who fairly early on, admittedly older than Grass, saw the iniquities of the Nazi regime and actually did get out and fight against it.
On Monday's edition of The Daily, we reflected on the life of German novelist Günter Grass, who's died this week, aged 87. All that and much more coming up in the next half hour, right here on The Recap, with me, Daniel Giacopelli. Now, this week, German novelist Günter Grass died at the age of 87. Among his many achievements, he wrote a classic at the first attempt with his novel Tin Drum, and also won the Nobel Prize for Literature. Tin Drum was the first part of what became known as the Danzig Trilogy, setting a high bar for European magical realism. Grass, who died on Monday, was a novelist, poet, essayist, dramatist, sculptor, and graphic artist, but his reputation was almost destroyed by his admission he had served in Adolf Hitler's SS. Well, on the Monocle Daily on Monday, Guy Delaney was joined in the studio by journalist Henrietta Foster and author and critic C.J. Schuller.
If you look at the sort of long stream of Grass's work, actually that admission is all the way through his work. I mean, if you look at Peeling the Onion, the book where he made that admission, there's a character called We Don't Do That, which is the typical Aryan boy, blonde hair, blue eyes, almost Nordic features, who is in a labour service battalion with Grass and says, every time he's asked to get a gun, we don't do that. And in fact, in the end, he's carted off to a concentration camp. And I think that's the great tragedy, in a way, of Günter Grass. He actually did do that. And, you know, the people he wanted to be, people he admired through his life, are people like Willy Brandt, who came from a fairly similar background, but who fairly early on, admittedly older than Grass, saw the iniquities of the Nazi regime and actually did get out and fight against it. And Grass is human like the rest of us. He actually made the decision. He fought against his own weakness all his life, not taking into account that he was 14. That being said, it is odd that he made that admission quite so late in life, even if he did say to his friends that he said his friends knew in the 50s and the 60s that he had been in the Waffen-SS.
I think it's possible that it's precisely because he was so free with his political opinions and he was so critical of his fellow Germans for not so much for their complicity during the Nazi years, but for their reluctance to acknowledge it and to own up to it, that when it then became apparent that he had been somewhat economical with the truth in the past, naturally that was going to be held against him. He was always a controversial and outspoken figure, not only about Nazism, but an opponent of German reunification, for example, because he feared that Germany would once again become too powerful and would not be able to use that power with responsibility. He got into hot water not so very long ago for criticising the German government's sale of submarines to Israel, which he thought would be used to launch weapons against Iran. And most recently, he criticised Angela Merkel for her stance on the Greek debt. So he wasn't afraid of controversy.
We did say in the introduction that he set the high bar for European magic realism. Now, magic realism is one of those styles which can be either utterly magical or, quite frankly, rather tiresome. How did Grass manage to fall on the magical side of this subgenre, do you think?
Oh, I think he didn't fall on the magical side, and that's what I like about him. I mean, for me, I'm afraid I do share your opinion, Guy. I'm not a great fan of magical realism, and I reluctantly have to admit that that's what he did. He called it himself broadened reality, and I like the fact, you know, your reality is a bit wider rather than magical. I think it worked for us because it's our culture and it's our continent he's talking about and our history. So yes, he had a character who never grew beyond the age of three, or yes, he had very strange people. He had a guy with an enormous Adam's apple that kept on bobbing, who was actually based on that character, We Don't Do That, that he met in his real life. But I mean, somehow I think he managed to not make it quite so like Borges or like Marquez. I think he managed to make it something different. I mean, but saying that, for me, the Grass that I like, all the Grass that got the bad reviews in the New York Times, I love his book, My Century, where he takes a whole century of German life through many, many different characters, from someone who signed Shelley up in 1907 to his concentration camp guard in Dachau in 1934, to a member of the Baader-Meinhof in the 70s, to some poor grandfather who was trying to prevent his grandchildren from being punks and pierced his own ears with safety pins and ended up in a lunatic asylum. I quite like that mundanity almost of Grass that, yes, has an element of magic realism, but I'm afraid I'm in your camp.
Guy Delaney from Monday's edition of The Monocle Daily, speaking to journalist Henrietta Foster and author and critic C.J. Schuller. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. I'm Daniel Giacopelli. On Tuesday, we were live from the Dry Cocktail Bar and Pizzeria in the heart of Milan's Brera neighborhood on Via Solferino, ahead of Salone del Mobile. Our editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé was joined by Monocle's design editor Tom Morris and our edit section editor Josh Fenner on a special edition of Midori House. In this highlight, they catch up with Monocle's Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho.
Gentlemen, you've been thumping and pounding the streets for about 36 hours now. Well, hopefully, Ivan, you did a little bit more because you live here. Ivan, maybe just to put this particular Salone in context for us, because you have all of these big brands also competing with the logo for Expo at the moment. And I'm wondering, I went by the exposition site yesterday and I saw a lot of cranes still swinging around the Expo site. So is there also a bit of a reputation issue at play here right now?
There is a bit, because work is going on frenetically. It's 24/7 to get things done these last few days. I've seen actually there are some events tied into Expo, various presentations of work. There's Riva 1920, who are doing these single-piece tables from various designers, Citerio, Lissoni, Iacchetti, for a project for Expo. So there's a lot of excitement that's coming up right after a furniture fair, which is, of course, a very, very big week for Milan.
Before we let them off the hook, or not quite, I mean, Italy does have a reputation for somehow just pulling it off at the very end. So do you think come May 1 it's going to happen, or they're hoping that it'll all be ready by Ferragosto or something like that?
I think the first few weeks there'll be some creative camouflage is what's been talked about. So maybe certain areas you'll see wrapped up in something that looks a bit glossy to sort of keep pedestrians sort of in that main sort of thoroughfare, but I think by middle of May, I think everything should be up and running.
So far, I mean, there was a number of previews yesterday, and we saw a lot of companies peddling their new wares just before the crush of today. Mm-hmm. Highlights so far, give us sort of three or four things that stood out already.
Well, the first, yeah, we landed yesterday, which was a great afternoon. I think the first, which went to in the sunshine yesterday, was the Cotto, which is an amazing Thai design company, bathroom brand, that's just hooked up with Piero Lissoni on an absolutely amazing collaboration. Just really, really sophisticated series of beautiful sort of textured tiles, some beautiful wash basins, and it was just an absolutely beautiful presentation as well. So that kind of kicked it off very nicely. Also went to see a great exhibition on the 80 years of Molteni, which is, of course, one of the big Italian manufacturers.
And the Molteni story seems to be, whether it's just in sheer email assault, really one of the big stories.
It is, because it's such a lovely brand, and it's, you know, obviously still family owned, and they've worked with some amazing designers over the years, and still, you know, a couple of years ago bought the rights to Gio Ponti's works. They're casually reissuing them, which we saw this afternoon at Salone, a nice armchair there. So it's a beautiful story that needs to be told, and they've got a fantastic exhibition. So it's quite nice to kick off Milan, seeing something more creative than just commercial.
Ivan.
Yeah, Molteni is really the made in Brianza story, because we have to talk about, when we say made in Italy in furniture, it's really made in Brianza a lot of times, just around Milan, lots of specialty companies using workshops who have know-how going back 3-4 generations.
When you look at, as you said, the sort of the specificity of talking about sort of made in Brianza, and, you know, over the years, you know, there's sort of ebbs and flows of made in Italy versus designed in Italy. A lot of companies now talking about, well, you know, we're an Italian company, but we've got manufacturing, you know, completely Italian managed in Albania, in Romania. Do you think there's this, I guess, sort of acceptance that it's as long as it's sort of made in the EU, and we're not sort of trucking it miles to get into living rooms in London or Brussels, then it's okay. Where do you think things stand in this, especially also in a year of Expo here as well?
No, I think foreigners still believe, when you look at, for example, also with fashion, you know, luxury goods, you know, furniture, a lot of clients are very demanding, and so they want to be guaranteed that these things are made, you know, by craftsmen here in Italy, because again, there's these districts that specialize, say, in glass or ceramics or woodwork, and, you know, those 3-4 generations of experience, they can just do that much better on the finishing that you want to have, that you'll pay the premium for it.
Tom, just looking ahead, you're here almost, like, you're here all the way through to departure time for Lisbon on Thursday night, Friday morning, whenever you're flying. What else will you be looking forward to this week? Because obviously, the lighting component, Iuriluce, is obviously the other big story, which we haven't even gone into yet.
But. So we'll be heading there tomorrow to see all the great new lights that are being launched this year. But it's always a nice treat towards the end of the week in Salone to kind of get the fiera out of the way, which is very enjoyable, but quite stressful. And then I think it's always nice to have a stomp around the city at the Fuori Salone stuff, go to Rossano or Lundy and the lovely things there, and have a spot of lunch. Design Junction is
a very long lunch.
Design Junction is bigger and better than ever this year, so I'm looking forward to seeing that. And it always, you know, it's so amazing to see kind of everyone in Milan really get behind Design Week and actually get its act together, and I just hope that when Expo comes they manage to do it for that as well, because they always put on a good show at Salone.
And that was a highlight from Tuesday's edition of Midori House, with our editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé, our design editor Tom Morris, and our edits section editor Josh Fenner, speaking with our Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho. Well, it's time now for a highlight from The Globalist. Wednesday was a big day in North Korea. It was the birthday of the pariah state's founding father, Kim Il-sung. Well, North Korea calls the anniversary the Day of the Sun, and they celebrate in an appropriately upbeat style. But human rights groups have been keen to point out that Kim Il-sung, like his son and grandson, who have followed him to the seat of power, was responsible for human rights abuses that sowed the seeds of North Korea's descent into dictatorship. Well, that day, Georgina Godwin was joined by John Everard, the UK's former ambassador to North Korea, to talk about the anniversary.
It's a day off for people, so ordinary North Koreans I knew really look forward to this. They tended to have to go to an event of some kind in the morning, a parade, a march, a political meeting, whatever, but they could spend the rest of their day with their families, which in North Korea is a big deal. You don't get a lot of family time. Mm-hmm. So they were very happy on the Day of the Sun. And as you say, the 103rd anniversary, Kim Il-sung was born on the day the Titanic sank. Not a good day for world history all round. Also, it turns out, today is the 50th anniversary of the Kim Il-sung flower, a particularly lurid purple orchid presented to Kim Il-sung during a state visit to Indonesia, and they've been having special meetings saying what a wonderful flower it is.
How fantastic. It's also his birthday was also the date that the calendar, the juche, is that how you pronounce it, calendar?
Juche, yes.
Is dated from. Just explain that to me.
The North Korean regime, when it got into stride, decided that the bourgeois Western calendar was inappropriate for the Korean people and invented a new revolutionary calendar starting with the year that Kim Il-sung was born, which of course is when real history starts. So we are now in Juche 104, just starting.
And Juche is also a form of ideology. It's central to the way that North Korea was governed by Kim Il-sung. Can you elaborate?
That's right. A form of ideology. It is wonderfully vague. Juche in Korean just means the subject of a verb. So it means that you go out and do things. Embarrassingly, it turns out that it was invented and presented to Kim Il-sung by a very senior North Korean official who since defected and who lived out the rest of his days in South Korea, which the North Koreans don't like to talk about.
Tell me now about Sungbong, the Sungbong system, because that was another of his big inventions.
That's right. Ancient Korea used to divide society into almost immovable layers, not a lot of social mobility, and you used to wear a little tag around your neck to show whether you were an artisan, a worker, a peasant, or whatever. And Kim Il-sung not so much invented, he simply reintroduced this system so that everybody was born into a fixed class, almost like an Indian caste. It matters a lot less now than it used to 10 years ago, because what really differentiates social class in North Korea now is whether you have money. It's getting to be quite materialistic. But formally speaking, people still have their Songbong classes, and they're still adhered to in things like political meetings.
Mm. Human Rights Watch has chosen this anniversary to point out that his grandson, Kim Jong-un, the current leader of the country, continues to follow those rights-abusing policies and should be called before the International Criminal Court to answer for the crimes. Is that ever likely to happen?
I think that is unlikely, but the prospect has clearly worried the North Koreans. Remember, it's not just Human Rights Watch who was saying this. The Commission of Inquiry of the United Nations recommended referral to the ICC in its report, and that was forwarded to the Security Council by the General Assembly. The Security Council is still thinking about what to do with it, but formally it is actually in the UN process. And the North Koreans, irrationally if you like, do appear worried that he might actually be hauled up in front of the ICC.
Well, tell us more about these human rights abuses.
Where do you start? There is a widespread repressive apparatus, extensive secret police, and horribly concentration camps, which at present incarcerate people aren't quite sure, probably about 200,000 people. One of the reasons, worse, that we're not sure is that a lot of the concentration camps are underground, so out of the reach of prying Western satellites. People who are simply incarcerated there and who never see the sunlight again. Torture in police stations is routine. Torture for even fairly minor offences like crossing the border without permission is also extremely common. No right of assembly, no right of worship, no freedom of expression, and division of families quite often. And the list goes on and on and on. The COI, the Commission of Inquiry for the UN, said that they'd never before seen human rights abuses of this kind anywhere.
We know that the population was completely brainwashed, but with the huge advances in technology, there must be some internal will for change. So will the celebrations today be genuine? I mean, are people completely behind the state, or do they see?
That's not an easy question to answer straight off. Firstly, North Koreans are not a homogenous mass. They're all different from each other. I mean, some are real patriots and believe everything they get from the government. Others are complete cynics, and you get everything in between. Secondly, all that North Koreans will be focusing on today is, like I said, having the day off. Or the political noise just goes on in the background. I don't think many of them actually internalise it. Whether or not you're behind the state, not surprisingly, tends to depend on how well the state treats you. If you are a member of the Pyongyang elite, you are in no hurry for a collapse of the regime, because it's actually just doing all right by you. If, however, you are an undernourished peasant somewhere out in the impoverished northeast, then you probably will be quite keen on seeing a few changes.
Mm. Now, you've referred to the Commission of Inquiry. That happened in February 2014. It seems shocking that it took that long for the rest of the world to get involved. Are we likely to see any action coming from the West to try and help the citizens of North Korea?
I'd love to be able to say yes. The question is, what actually do you do? We have delivered humanitarian aid in very large quantities for a long time, so that we like to think that in some way we have alleviated the immediate physical suffering of malnutrition, going on starvation at various points. But actually improving the general lot of North Koreans is extremely difficult given the self-isolation of the state and the North Korean state's absolute refusal to reform. We're up against a brick wall.
Britain's former man in Pyongyang there, John Everard, speaking to Georgina Godwin on Wednesday's edition of The Globalist. Up next, a century-old problem. Stay tuned.
Monaco has shops around the world selling our exclusive collaborations with some of our favourite designers, including Ettinger, Porter, Barenna, Jawbone, Oliver Peoples, and many more. You can find us on College Street in Toronto, Hudson and Charles in New York, and in the heart of Wan Chai in Hong Kong, and two in London. So, whether you're after a versatile travelling wardrobe, something for the home, or a present for a loved one, or just missing back issues from your collection, you're sure to find something at the Monocle Shop.
You're listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows hosted here at Monocle 24. I'm Daniel Giacopelli. The Ottoman Turks used more than words as weapons back in 1915, but it is semantics that's causing metaphorical daggers to be drawn now as the European Parliament prepares to debate a resolution to mark the 100th anniversary of the event. Turkey accepts that Armenians died, but they still deny hundreds of thousands were killed or that it amounted to any kind of genocide. And it's the use of that term by the Pope that's so upset Tayyip Erdogan and his government. Armenia has demanded an apology and compensation for the 1.5 million of its people it claims were murdered. The Vatican's ambassador to Turkey's foreign ministry has been summoned, whilst their own envoy has been recalled. The rhetoric stepped up a little bit on Wednesday, when the Turkish prime minister accused the pontiff of joining plots against his Justice and Development Party. To get to the bottom of a problem that's been simmering for almost a century, Georgina Godwin was joined by Dr. Simon Waldman of the Turkish Studies Research Group at King's College London in this highlight from Thursday's Globalist.
100 years ago, it was in the context of World War I, 1915, in fact, 100 years ago from today, there was the deportations on a large scale of the Armenian population of Anatolia, which was then the Ottoman Empire, into the deserts or the wastelands that surrounding the areas. The reason being was this was in the context of World War I. The Armenian population in Anatolia were essentially considered to be fifth columnists, working with the Russians against the Ottoman Empire. And it was this sense of real desperation on the part of the Ottoman Empire that they carried out these deportations, which led to the deaths of anywhere between 800,000 to 1.5 million Armenian people.
And it's hugely disputed. Both sides have different stories.
Everything is disputed in terms of figures, absolutely.
Why is the EU debating it now, though?
Well, the EU is debating it now because it's the 100-year anniversary of the Armenian genocide. Now, it's not the first time the European Union has debated it. It's not the first time that it's become an issue on the international stage. It's not the first time that it's been debated in different parliaments across Europe and the international community. But there have been attempts, especially on the part of different Armenian groups, to raise awareness of the Armenian genocide because it's the centenary. And on the same side of the, on the other side of the coin, different Turkish lobbyists have been trying to counter Armenian efforts, and we're seeing this happening right now.
Is it, though, a genuine festering thing on the kind of Turkish and Armenian psyche, or is it politics?
What it is both, just to rephrase your question, is why is what happened 100 years ago a political question in Turkey today? The reason being, and the reason why this is the case, is this is a source of national pride. The founding fathers of the Turkish Republic are essentially standing accused of committing genocide, and this is a huge issue in such a nationalist country and patriotic country such as Turkey.
Can we look at the specific remarks? That's what the PM actually said about AK's rivals on the whole genocide issue, because he criticised the Republican People's Party, the CHP, of being helped by a US-based strategic research consultancy. He also called the pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party, the HDP, a project to hamper the AK party's progress. Are there any substance to these claims?
Well, I mean, in terms of using PR firms and things like that, I mean, this is not anything new to hire PR companies for political campaigns. But what this really represents is political point scoring, using any kind of issue that comes up that's being discussed in the Turkish media or whatever to gain support in elections that's coming up in June, because a lot of things are being decided from the June elections, from anything from having enough parliamentarians in the case of the ruling AKP party to change the constitution. So when something so explosive such as the Armenian genocide comes up, of course members of the ruling government are going to try and use it and delegitimize their political rivals.
Now Erdogan needs at least 400 seats to be able to change that constitution completely unopposed. Polls suggest that that might be a problem, though, that he may not get that amount.
There's a lot of dynamics taking place in terms of how many seats it needs. I don't think it's quite as high as 400, but that was what he had earlier, around that figure, had hoped to expect. Now, whether that's possible or not, there's so many different things which could take place. One of the most important things, which I would suggest that people look out for, is the success of the HDP, or in other words, the pro-Kurdish party in Turkey. In Turkey, there is a 10% threshold for parties that they have to reach in order to gain seats in parliament. And this is the first time that the HDP is running as a party. Before, they ran as independents in order to bypass that 10% threshold. Now, this is quite a gamble for the HDP. And if they don't make it, and if they don't make that 10% threshold, then the AKP, the ruling government, in other words, will be able to have a very large majority in parliament and then change the constitution. So that's to watch out for there.
Dr. Simon Waldman of the Turkish Studies Research Group at King's College London there, speaking to Monocle's Georgina Godwin in a highlight from Thursday's edition of The Globalist. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. And just before we head off, we turn to Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief Thomas Lewis, who looks at the leadership race in Quebec on Friday's edition of The Globalist.
Pierre-Carl Péladeau is not, in conventional terms, a politician. He was one of Quebec's most famous business personalities, becoming the CEO of his father's vast media empire, Quebecor, in 1999. But in March last year, Mr. Péladeau shocked both the business and political worlds in Quebec by announcing his intention to run as a member of the Quebec Assembly, a race he eventually won comfortably. Now the 53-year-old has emerged as the front-runner in the race to lead the Parti Québécois. The King of Quebec, as he was described in one magazine last year, represented something of a political masterstroke for the Parti Québécois, which, historically, has found it difficult to lure business leaders into its fold. Here was one of the territory's most famous business personalities, leaving behind the family corporation and throwing his hat into the bullring of Québécois politics. This, the commentator said, was a moment when the PQ could begin crafting a more compelling and more credible economic pulpit from which to preach its message of sovereignty. But the campaign so far has revealed that Mr. Péladeau's experience in business has not translated into a natural mastery of the political sphere. His early claims that his goal was to make Quebec a country jolted many. The PQ has a more nuanced approach to the sovereignty question since the narrowly lost referendum in 1995, a hard-won shifting of the tone that seemed in the early days of his political career to pass Mr. Péladeau by. So what kind of leader will Mr. Péladeau, who is almost certain to win the vote next month, be? The next elections here are not until 2018, and most of the commentators I've spoken to here say that those 3 years will be crucial in turning Mr. Péladeau from a personality into a politician. The appetite for sovereignty is an issue in the margins at present here in Quebec. Opinion polls suggest some 35-40% of the population would like another chance to go it alone. Not an insubstantial majority then, but as one journalist I spoke to put it, Quebec today is not the Quebec of 1995. Other concerns, the economy, the language, university tuition fees, have slipped into the breach left by the independence debate. Mr. Péladeau then must craft a response to those concerns if he is to persuade Quebecers that sovereignty, so palpable a prospect 20 years ago, is indeed the most fruitful path ahead for this part of the country. For Monocle in Montreal, I'm Thomas Lewis.
Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's edition of The Recap. The show is produced by Carlotta Ribello and edited by Sam Impey. I'm Daniel Giacopelli. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programming here on Monocle 24. But for now, thanks for listening. Goodbye.